We are back. Speak up, Las Cruces. In this last segment, we're going to be speaking with symphony conductor Lonnie Klein, who has an interesting presentation coming up for the Academy for Learning in Retirement in September. It's titled Music in Revolution and Evolution, Beyond the Velvet Curtain, Radical Melodies, Harmonies, Orchestration, and Rhythm from 1800 to 1940. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So let's start by just, you know, you are tackling everything from Beethoven to the jazz movement in America, all in this one four series. But what is the unifying, how do all of those things tie together, I guess is what
I'm actually going back to antiquity. So in order to understand the first session, which is primarily about Beethoven and the Fifth Symphony, and the ramifications that had in terms of evolution and revolution, I'm actually going back to antiquity and then working through the Middle Ages and then Renaissance, Baroque, Classical, and then the Romantic. Okay. So to gain a perspective of Beethoven, we go back to the early church, where we just have monody.
Gregorian chants.
Yeah, their Gregorian chants. Okay. So the audience just hears a Gregorian chant. And then we go into the Renaissance, where that music's expanded into the church more, where we have harmony and singers, and eventually we have instruments. And then the Renaissance will have secular musicians suddenly playing in the streets, in the taverns, certainly in the castle, the aristocracy. Mm-hmm. And so that transition, it's going to be very brief, 30 minutes, but it gives the audience a perspective of how Beethoven changed even more than radically than perhaps Haydn or Mozart. And I'll be playing some of their music as well. So, for example, Haydn wrote 104 symphonies, and Mozart wrote 41, and Beethoven wrote 9. Now, how do you describe that? I'm going to tell you, but that's the transition. Beethoven's music was much more complex, right, much more dramatic. It was longer. He expanded the orchestra. He added percussion instruments that weren't used before. So that I'm going back to antiquity just so the audience has relevance with Beethoven's music, particularly the Fifth Symphony.
So what is it about, and the first thing people, bum, 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 I mean, that is probably the most famous chord progression ever written.
It is. I call it the four notes that changed the world.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, you wouldn't think that, ba 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 ba, ba 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 ba.
Yeah, over and over again, but you know, different, yeah.
Yeah, and so that's a motive. And he actually took a motive, that motive, and made it into a melody, and it has rhythmic energy. And he starts on the offbeat. It's actually an eighth note rest. And two, and one.
Okay.
And two, and one. That's the rest. And so that was unusual. And there's no introduction. He just goes right into the exposition, right into it. And he uses rest as energy. So it's like and that tension and that rhythmic energy and vitality really drives that symphony.
And it builds on itself.
Yeah, it does build. Yes, yes. You're exactly right. It builds on itself in terms of, you know, tension and rhythmic energy and drive, and he just keeps building. And of course, he expanded what we call the development section. Sort of like taking laundry and throwing it in your washer and mixing it all up. That's what the middle section is. He also did away with the minuet and trio that we know of, certainly from Haydn and Mozart. His third movement is a scherzo. So it's not a dance anymore. It's not a slow one, two, three, one. It's one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. It's in one. So he didn't intend for you to dance to it.
Right.
He wanted you to listen to it.
Right.
And the most significant thing, of course, is modulation from C minor to C major, because that da-da-da-da is a fate motive, and that reoccurs, that rhythmic throughout the symphony in various components, but he modulates from C minor to C major, and that's triumph. I'm triumphing over fate. Right. That's the fate motive, and so it modulates to C major. And another significant thing he did in terms of orchestration, he added a piccolo, he added a contrabassoon, and he added three trombones. That had never been done before. Certainly Mozart had one trombone in his Requiem,
right.
But to add three trombones and a piccolo and a contrabassoon, which is lower than a regular bassoon, twice the size practically, that hadn't been done before, and he only used them in the fourth movement. So these poor musicians are sitting there for three movements, then they play the fourth movement. So it's pretty exciting music, and it's stood the test of time for, you know, hundreds of years. And that's just one of his symphonies. The most famous would be the Ninth as well, the Third Symphony, the Eroica, not to mention his five piano concertos, his violin concerto, his sonatas. Just a prolific composer, and he only lived to be 57.
Right, right.
And when he wrote this symphony, number 5, he started in 1804 and it was finished in actually 1808 because he was working on other music. But by then he was completely deaf.
Yes, wow. Right. The other amazing thing.
We should mention, I don't think you mentioned this yet, but the ALR, Academy of Learning and Retirement, sessions, presentations that you're going to do, are Tuesday and Thursday the next couple of weeks, September 2nd, September 4th, September 9th, September 10th. So Tuesday and Thursday, then Tuesday and Wednesday the next week. And they're not going to be on Zoom this time, right?
That's correct. My presentations are not going to be on Zoom because a number of things. First of all, some of the music I'm playing is copyrighted.
Right.
And I don't want to violate copyright law. That would get everybody in trouble, including myself.
Where is the event?
It's going to be at the Doña Ana Community College off of Sonoma Ranch Boulevard.
Correct.
The branch there in the auditorium.
Right. And I think you can sign up ahead of time at the DACC website, just Google Academy for ALR.
Right. You can sign up early or you can pay. I don't think they'd use credit cards, but it's $5. You can pay at the door. Right. I think a lot of patrons do that.
Yeah.
I enjoyed listening to a lot of symphonies that you conducted over the years.
Mm-hmm.
What started you on your road to being a conductor?
Gosh, I was a kid. When I was in the fifth grade, I wanted to play in the band. My father was a musician. And I wanted to play in the band. Once I joined the band, it's just something I had to do. I just loved it. I took private lessons eventually when I was a seventh grader from the university in Evansville, Indiana. I studied with a professor. He really helped along the way. I had some really fine teachers that would take me to symphony concerts.
Mm.
And I heard the Evansville Philharmonic many, many times as a kid. And I just knew I wanted to be a conductor. Somehow I was going to be a musician.
Yeah.
I enjoyed playing clarinet in the orchestra. I played for many, many years in Owensboro, Paducah, Evansville, Michigan in particular, as principal clarinetist. But I'd always been studying conducting, and I had good coaches, and I've been fortunate, actually. There's too many orchestra, too many conductors, and not enough orchestras.
Yeah.
So my 22-year tenure here was, you know, unusual in that regard.
Well, and certainly was well received, and you brought us a lot of terrific music. And
thank you
from the community. I want to get back to your presentations. Mm-hmm. The second one is featuring somebody who I'm not familiar with at all.
Oh, okay. So this is Hector Berlioz, and you know the title of this is the Orchestrator. And so this particular symphony, Symphony Fantastique, and that's the name of it. It's a fantastic symphony, and So Beethoven died in 1827. This symphony was written in 1828, one year after Beethoven died. And Berlioz did not live in Vienna. He lived in Paris. And what he did was just absolutely turn the orchestra literally upside down. So this symphony, now think about it, 1 year after Beethoven died, this symphony has five movements now, not four. And it, the orchestration is huge, like two sets of timpani, a whole battery of percussion.
So it's really hitting.
It's a, you have to have a huge orchestra.
Yeah.
Piccolo, E-flat clarinet, trombones, multiple trumpets, six French horns, a large string section, plus harp. And the most striking thing about it, it's programmatic. Programmatic meaning it's telling a story. So, and the story is pretty macabre because now we're in the Romantic period. So five movements. The story is that Berlioz falls in love with a singer and she doesn't like him and ignores him. But eventually he woos her and they become a couple. That's the first movement. Then they go to the ball, the second movement. Then he has a dream that the third movement where... he thinks she's having an affair. Oh my gosh. So what happens? He kills her. Can you imagine? This is in a symphony. And then the fourth movement is march to the scaffold. So they actually kill him. And the fifth movement is the witch's dance. And he's going to be tortured. And that's how it ends. And so some of the techniques that he used were like witches flying around on their brooms, hitting each other. And it's called colegno, where the strings take the wood part of their bow and slap the string. Mm-hmm. And that's the effect of a witch's broom hitting each other. It's just remarkable writing. And again, a programmatic story. Telling a story. It made him very famous, his symphony.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then you go from there to Tchaikovsky, Dvorak, and Chopin. You talk nationalism, mm-hmm. which I guess I never thought of it in terms of that.
Well, nationalism, so we move from the West to the East. So we primarily focused on Vienna, certainly Berlin, France. And so composers in the East. So now we're looking at Czechoslovakia, we're looking at Poland, we're certainly looking at Russia. Right. And so these composers wrote in a Western style, but with their nationalistic fervor, whether it be folk tunes from their country. So Dvorak, the Czech music of Dvorak is just wonderful. Then I'm going to go to Finland and do Smetana and do Finlandia, and you'll hear that sort of mm-hmm. regional folk music. And certainly I can't even say anything about Tchaikovsky. He was just a brilliant composer, and with his 1812 overture and March Slav and his six symphonies, the opera, his piano concertos, his violin concerto. When you hear Tchaikovsky's music, you just instantly know that doesn't sound like Beethoven.
Right.
That is certainly not Mozart. So we have this nationalistic trend going, and composers like Chopin was Polish, and he wrote most of his mazurkas, his waltzes, his nocturnes, very much in a Polish style.
Yeah.
You can tell that way differently than Dvorak, the Czech style. And so we call it nationalism.
By this time, were people able to hear the music from other countries?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. These musicians traveled. You know, Tchaikovsky went to America and premiered some of his music and conducted.
Okay. Yeah.
Certainly, the composers were traveling. They knew each other. So, for instance, Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven knew each other in Vienna. They didn't have a lot of interaction, but they knew each other. They knew of each other.
Right, right. And they were listening to each other's works.
Absolutely, studying their scores. Right. And so, I'm not going to talk about it, but there's also a subsection of this Romantic era. So the late 19th century, there's a movement called Expressionism and Exoticism. And that would be Debussy. That certainly would be Ravel, mm-hmm. where they're taking music from another country and extrapolating it and making it music of their country. So, for instance, Ravel wrote lots. He traveled to Spain a lot, and he would write in a French style, the French style, but incorporating the music perhaps of Spain.
Right, right.
Rhapsody Español is a perfect example. And Bolero and La Valse.
Right, right.
So that's another, that would be another topic that we don't have time for.
Well, and then you wrap it all up with American jazz, which seems like a jump to me to go from classical music to American
jazz.
Well,
by this time, by the early, certainly the early 20th century, America was becoming prominent. We had conservatories now. We certainly had some orchestras. And so we had this American, you know, sort of nationalistic style of writing. And in particular, Gershwin, we all know he wrote great musicals. We know that he was an excellent pianist. But he actually wanted to be considered a serious composer. Mm-hmm. And he incorporated a lot of jazz elements, idioms into his music. For instance, Rhapsody in Blue,
right,
famous concerto, piano concerto, if you will, Rhapsody. So that's finally the Americans. And then you certainly can't overlook Leonard Bernstein. I mean, pianist, mm-hmm, composer, conductor, author, and certainly best known for West Side Story,
right,
which is a takeoff of Romeo and Juliet.
Yes.
And the Jets and the Sharks in New York City are fighting each other, and we have all that beautiful music. And he was, you know, he's a great composer. So you'll hear that element, and you'll hear, if I have time, I want to talk about Gottschalk and William Grant Still, really early American 20th century American black composer. Mm-hmm. Who studied at a conservatory and was very prominent. And as a matter of fact, I love his first two symphonies. So I want to talk about how he incorporated, you know, gospel songs and slave songs into Western art music as we know it. Very different writing than what Bernstein and Copland were doing.
Right.
And Gershwin.
I'm not sure how to phrase this question. Thinking about the, I know it's not part of your topic, but the exclusionary, the way that symphonies were excluded women, for example, musicians. And I'm also thinking about with blacks, there are stories in you know, painting where a guy won an award at Philadelphia Museum, won the best painting of the year. And he didn't show up because he tried to get in and they wouldn't let him in because he was black.
Mm-hmm.
How much was music exclusionary ethnically and in terms of women?
Well, certainly that was the case in Europe. As a matter of fact, the Berlin Phil didn't have a woman until they hired Sabrina Meyer, the principal clarinetist. A lot of European orchestras up until about 20 years ago had pretty much men, especially the big orchestras. That's not the case anymore, certainly in Europe. It perhaps was the case in America, but it's shifted so much. I mean, as a music director, I didn't care if you were an apple or a banana, if you could play the violin and you auditioned and you played better than anyone else, I hired you. There's excellent, excellent, superior women musicians. It's just look at the guest artist list that I had.
Sure.
I mean, half were women. They played. I just wasn't concerned about what color, what country. I was only concerned about how they play. And I'm sure that conductors now, they want the best musicians in the orchestra.
Now they're, I wondered historically. Anyway, it's kind of off topic.
Mm-hmm.
But
I haven't really studied that. I don't know the makeup of orchestras back, you know, in the early 20th century, at least in America.
Right.
So
it seems like the thing that's tying all of these together is that there were big changes that took music in a new direction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that still possible today?
Oh, absolutely. Oh,
And what are you excited about when you look at music that's being made today? Is there anything that's catching your attention?
Well, there's lots of composers that catch my attention. You know, one of the unique things that we did when I was music director of the Las Cruces Symphonies, we commissioned 10 works. 10, not, you know, dead composers. These were American composers. We had Joan Tower, to your point. Very famous woman composer. I had Joseph Schwantner. We commissioned a work from him. We commissioned Bill McLaughlin from St. Paul Sunday Morning. Remember that show? He wrote a piece for us. So I was very much inclined to perform music, not of dead white European males, but music of our time. And so it was a challenge to find a composer and certainly raise the money. Commissions are not expensive. That first commission, it was a consortium. It was $100,000, and it was 10 minutes. It's typically $10,000 a minute for a new composition. And so I partnered with orchestras throughout the country, but we had the mountain premiere. So the deal was you had the East Coast premiere, the Midwest premiere, the mountain premiere, which was LCSO, and then the West Coast.
Okay.
And the composer, part of the contract was the composer would come to each premiere. So it was exciting for me to meet the composer, talk to them, premiere this new work, and the most famous one I did, and it was actually played on National Public Radio. As we commissioned Bill McLaughlin, he wrote a piece called Remembering Icarus, and it was a fantastic piece, and I knew it was going to be fantastic after we performed it. It was submitted to Fred Childs at Performance Today. It went through the engineering committee, went through the artistic committee, and lo and behold, I got a call and said, we're gonna perform this. The scary part of that, it was December 8th, 2005. I was in Michigan conducting a Christmas Pops with the Traverse City Symphony Orchestra, and I was in my car. And I knew what time it was going to come on, and they just performed Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic. And then I heard it, and they go, oh, my gosh, up next is the Las Cruces Symphony. I think, oh, my gosh, I got to follow New York Philharmonic and Leonard Bernstein. But it was exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Exciting for the to the orchestra. To your point, there are hundreds of composers that are performing and conducting and composing music. I mean, a perfect example would be just look at John Williams. He's a serious composer. Now, yes, he writes for film, but he's written some excellent music that will stand on its own without the film. It's that kind of music that is being written by scores of composers in this country.
We are down to our last few minutes. What haven't we asked you about?
I don't know. I was vice president of my fifth grade class.
Well, tell us about that.
Let me ask you this. When you think about all the conducting a symphony, I mean, it's got to be incredibly complex and, you know, a bunch of people, a bunch of musicians, artists. What's the most comical disaster, maybe not comical at the time, but what's the most, you know, extreme screw-up that ever happened?
Well, we try to avoid that, certainly, but it's a live performance and things can happen. The one that in particular that comes to mind, I was doing an Italian pianist, and we were doing a Mozart piano concerto. And in Mozart, it's like in any concerto, typically the exposition's repeated. So in other words, you play the opening and then you repeat it. And then you go to the B section and then you go back to the A. So it's really ABA form. So we're playing, we open the introduction, we're playing the concerto. He didn't repeat. He went right into the development section. In other words, he just skipped he skipped 80 measures of music or whatever. I went back and did my repeat because I can't move 70 musicians. I can't move them.
Right.
And they know we're repeating. So I went back and repeated, and I just looked at, I just kept conducting. I just looked at him. I'm like, dude, you're on your own. You're going to have to find, you're going to have to find me.
We want to thank you, Lonnie Klein, symphony, longtime symphony conductor here. We've been talking about the presentation you're going to do at Academy for Learning and Retirement at Doñana Community College the first couple of weeks in September. Urge people to sign up for that. And thanks for being with us.
Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate the opportunity.